We really think European butter from France is the best butter. And our friend, the expert baker and best-selling cookbook author David Leibovitz agrees. Check out our recent episode with David to find out how he cooks with quality butter. And for recipes, tips, and cooking advice, go to tasteeurope.com.
In those days, giants roamed the earth. And if you were one of the people lucky enough to live downtown in a $150 a month apartment, you would see Allen Ginsberg, you would see Iggy Pop, you would see Basquiat, who famously worked at a bar back at a club I used to go to all the time, and everybody was friends with him.
This is Taste. I'm your host, Matt Rodbard. It's so much fun having two food writers I respect on the show. First up is Robert Sietsema. Robert is a longtime New York City restaurant critic and neighborhood wanderer who has written for The Village Voice, Eater, and prior to that ran the influential underground food zine Down the Hatch. We talk about the early days of food writing and what is exciting him in New York City right now. Luke Pyonson is a food and travel writer in New York City. His work has appeared in the Boston Globe, the New York Times, and on Taste, where he recently wrote about menu telephone hotlines. We talk about Luke's career, drumming in the band Frankie Cosmos, and his upcoming book, Taste in Music. I really hope you enjoy these conversations. Robert Sietsema, welcome to This Is Taste. How the heck are you?
Hey, Matt. Thanks for asking. I'm feeling great.
Oh, my gosh. I love catching up with you. We've had meals over the years, and you've been on the show before. I haven't seen you, I don't think, since before the pandemic. How was your pandemic?
Oh, I loved it. I mean, I had no problem at all. I mean, I got sick a couple times, but it was such an exciting time in retrospect. And despite the fact that, sadly, so many people died, it was also a time when all of our ideas about food and everything were being remade minute by minute.
Yeah, I think it's such an astute observation. And as somebody who covers New York with aggression and with love and verve, you saw this great shift in the dining scene, so many closures, so many pivots. What do you take away from that era in terms of the big like changes that remained?
On the negative side of the ledger, which I'll begin with, many, many people of a certain social class became accustomed to always having their food delivered by a subclass of people who are not paid very much, who ride bicycles dangerously all the time. And let's face it, food that's delivered is about 10% as good as food that you get when it like is produced right on the spot.
If it's wrapped in a tortilla, I'm going to say about 90% worse.
Yeah, although there are things that are improved by delivery, like maybe an Indian curry might like kind of get better as it mellows on the bicycle seat. And on the positive side of the ledger, this outdoor dining fad has been just wonderful for the life of the city to see. So many people outside, even when it's freezing, they're freezing their asses off and they're eating because they love to eat outside.
I know. And I think we've figured out what the shelters were all about and we figured out the right regulations for those. Ultimately, it got us dining in unique spaces. I agree fully. That was a very cool thing to see about the pandemic. Yeah. What was it? Was there a closure that made you the most sad during the pandemic?
Oh, my God. I would have to think about that a while.
Yeah.
There were so many of them.
Yeah.
Spain.
Yeah.
Seeing that old-fashioned Spanish restaurant close down. So many restaurants, you know, the problem with the outdoor thing was that it was not administered fairly. Places that were on a corner might have had twice as much space outside. Spaces that were by a bus stop or a fire plug or were just plain narrow spaces just did not have any room. And Spain was one of those places that just had no place to put an outdoor dining space. And even though people were into nostalgic food, they wanted comfort food during the pandemic, they didn't want to go inside into like an old kind of subterranean
space. Which is such a shame.
Yeah, with the germs crawling everywhere.
Yeah, we can retroactively look at the germ thing many times over. But, you know, just the fact that we're losing these establishments and these great war horses of New York was such a sad part of the pandemic. And I feel you yourself have covered the establishment so well. And I want to segue to what we're going to talk about, which is the 1990s.
Oh, boy.
Robert, you have been writing about food professionally in New York for over 30 years, probably longer. And I've been blessed with, long story short, I am friends with the guys at Kitchen Arts and Letters. And I went up there in 2022 just to check in with Matt and the crew. And they mentioned they had an almost complete collection of Down the Hatch for Sale, which is your legendary staple and print zine, started in 91. Is that correct?
I think at the very end of 89, and it ran through 1994.
So it was 89. I'm probably...
But very near the end of that. So,
okay,
yeah.
90, 89. So I now am the holder of a almost full copy of Down the Hatch, and I've been picking through it for over a couple of years.
Don't forget to mention how cheesy it is. It's like Xeroxed onto colored paper surreptitiously.
Robert,
in an office.
Have you seen modern publishing these days? Have you seen like the Drunken Canal? Like, people would die for that aesthetic. Like, you've created early graphic design. You said your wife did a lot of the illustration.
Right, right.
You call it cheesy. I call it absolute legend status design.
Thank you so much. I'll tell her.
No, it's beautiful work. And really, I mean, the design is one thing and the aesthetic, and we love zine culture. But man, the work you were putting in and Down the Hatch. And I hope to have you back for a Down the Hatch full episode. But I want to focus this on the 90s. And first question is, you know, in the early 1990s, when you started writing Down the Hatch, let me ask you, you know, what first comes to mind when you think of that era, 90, 91 New York? And what are some of the big stories of the time?
Well, of course, for me, central was the fact that all of these immigrant groups were coming into town. This is pre-Trumpian, when they tried to keep them out. But at the time, I remember I began my count at 100 ethnicities of people. And at the time, the restriction of most journalists was to stay in Manhattan.
Yeah.
Brooklyn had not happened yet. I know that's like a bizarre thing to say, since, of course, people were living there already. Many famous people were coming from there. But like in Saturday Night Fever,
They
were like trying as hard as hell to get to Manhattan and stay there.
Yeah.
So all over the five boroughs, though, and into New Jersey and Westchester and Long Island, there were all of these ethnicities starting restaurants, ma and pa places that were incredibly inexpensive because the other immigrants who wanted to eat the food, they couldn't afford a lot more. And so these really inexpensive places were serving the most exciting food in the city, and really, apart from a few earlier people like Milton Glaser at the Underground Gourmet.
Famously the first Underground Gourmet, in addition to founding New York Magazine, or helping with this founding aesthetic of New York Magazine, was the first Underground Gourmet. Yep.
And the designer of I Love New York.
Of course, Milton. R.I.P. Did you have meals with Milton? Did you guys share?
I never met him, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was one of those people where I always got there about 10 minutes after he'd left, and I'm going like, God, I wish I'd met him. Robert Frank is another guy that I would have killed
meet. Can you imagine?
And I've been told a couple times, oh, he was in the gallery right behind you and you didn't see him.
Oh, tell me about the specific communities when you talk about the 100 plus ethnicities and nationalities and folks, you know, moving to New York and creating a food culture in the 90s. Were there some that came to mind that were more prominent, that you at least were writing about more?
Oh, God, yes. Even the most exciting thing was to find out about a place where I didn't even know where it was on the map. And Uzbekistan was one of those places. And I stumbled on my first Uzbeki restaurant in Rego Park, Queens. And I brought with me a Russian speaker, figuring that since it had been part of the old Soviet Union, that they would speak Russian. And they didn't. So, you know, and
confused
and
faces there.
Finding Mexican restaurants from Puebla, who were the first immigrants that came here. I had heard rumors that this was because a Volkswagen plant had closed in the city of Puebla. And that's why, you know, I was wondering, why are these Mexican immigrants coming to New York rather than California? And it turned out that there were relatively inexpensive flights to New York. It was easier to get here. There were more opportunities, but they were really here because of a 10-year drought.
Mm.
The southern part of Puebla, where they all came from, is just dry as a bone, and they hadn't had any rain. All the livestock were dying. And so they came here bringing their food, which was quite unlike what we were what we'd had
And was
before.
That around Sunset Park, or was that up in Queens where those communities were at the time?
The earliest ones were in Harlem. They were in Sunset Park. You're right. They were in Bushwick. Bushwick, yeah. Before Bushwick happened in the popular imagination. Bushwick is where all the tortilla factories were, and they were making these white corn tortillas. Yeah. Because they vastly preferred to make quesadillas and things that they formed out of masa by hand. So while all the Californians are saying, why are these white tortillas so crappy? You know, it was because it was like white bread. Would you hand someone a loaf of Wonder Bread if they No. came here and say, this is American bread?
Interestingly, you recently wrote about Bushwick's booming taco scene in 2024. It's a bit of a full circle. And I have to say about the Poblano chef and back, you know, back of the house labor force, you know, very, very prominent in New York.
Oh, yeah.
Latino, immigration. We're talking, this is the culture that created so many back of house stars, you know, in the restaurant game.
Oh, my God. Yes. There was a point at which people said, no matter who your French chef is or your Italian chef, it is Mexicans who are actually making the great food back in the back of the kitchen. And now, I mean, then Ecuadorians came in, and now it's starting to be West Africans.
Yep. And always been a fascination of yours, and a real, you've been one of the best reporters of sub-Saharan Africa in New York writ large. So.
Well, the food is so good, and it's so, you know, it's French influenced, it's tribally influenced, it's just, it's fantastic. Yeah. It uses palm oil, which, as you know, is a cookbook maven, you have been in and out of popularity. Yeah. People say, oh, this will kill you. And other people say, oh, this is the best thing in the world. And so,
Well, there's red palm now that's artisanal and really used as its distinct flavor profile. I mean, we've talked about in the show. Let me ask you, when you talk about the celebrity chefs of the early 90s, I'd love to get a sense of who is on your radar. I know Counterculture, your longtime column in the Village Voice. Sorry, Counterintelligence was it Counterculture?
Jonathan Gold was Counterintelligence. I was Counterculture.
You were culture. He was intelligence. I thought I was flipping it. Okay, great. But you obviously covered Outer Borough and small restaurants, but you also dove into the celebrity chef realm a bit.
Oh, definitely. It seems that if you're going to be a food critic, you better know the entire spectrum of New York restaurants. And to the extent that the budget allowed it, I would go to places like Gotham Bar and Grill, which is Alfred Portale. Yeah. And that was like one of the most influential restaurants of that time, founded in 1986. He invented big food, which had a gigantic impact upon cookbooks.
Yeah.
Suddenly, everyone was taking their shrimp, you know, salad and piling it high on the plate in a kind of a dangerous fashion.
Yeah. Structure. I mean, John George as well picked that up a bit too in later days.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. But lots of structure there.
Everybody was doing it. I mean, and it was kind of hard to eat for the diner. It was, you know, but it did presage the Instagram age. The fact that suddenly food was becoming as important visually as it was taste-wise. It used to be that, you know, the old French chefs, they would cook things and throw it on the plate. It looked good and everything, but they weren't striving to be artists, you know, with the way the food looked.
We fetishized the restaurant Dorsia, you know, the fictional restaurant in American Psycho, and it's now and used as a name for an app for restaurant reservations. It's hilarious. But do you recall the era of Dorsia, you know, this era of when food became a real cultural currency, kind of at a level it is now? I mean, it was like really like the restaurant reservation became extremely important for Wall Street and uptown established money equally.
Oh, yeah. And that was actually a golden age because it was pre-social media. Social media, in many ways, have kind of ruined restaurant dining.
Very well said.
It's made it, but back then, which is what I call the start of the age of foodism, when suddenly food became your entertainment. In the days of old New York, An evening out might include getting a drink, going to a show, then eating your late supper or eating first and then having a drink afterwards. But suddenly the drink and the Broadway show or the movie were just gone. The rock concert was gone. And the food, not only did it become more expensive, but it became the focus of your entertainment. And at the same time, things shifted from midtown to downtown. And suddenly downtown was hot. And all the, and once again, Gotham Bar and Grill, when it appeared in 1986 in Greenwich Village, everyone's going like, what is this expensive restaurant doing here? We've never had anything quite like this. And
did you ever see Warhol out? Do you see Gordon Mata out? I mean, those are like,
oh, some, God, yes.
Those are the guys who were, you know, blending this downtown art scene with restaurants. And those are guys, I mean, Basquiat as well, who were, I mean, Warhol, famously a bit of a food guy himself, and Gordon Mata. Clark, you know, created his own restaurant, which became a scene. And I feel like this is kind of that area you're speaking about.
Yeah. It in those days, giants roamed the earth.
Yeah.
And if you were one of the people lucky enough to live downtown in a $150 a month apartment, you would see Allen Ginsberg, you would see Iggy Pop, you would see Basquiat, who famously worked at a bar back at a club I used to go to all the time, and everybody was friends with him. And nowadays, it's all been written out of his biography. It's not there anymore. They're just talking about his art bona fides.
Yeah.
But Warhol was a man of the people while being somewhere on the spectrum at the same time. He would glassy-eyed wander the streets of downtown. I had a friend who was a professional photographer who lived at the corner in a loft at the corner of Delancey and Bowery. And all four buildings on those corners were owned by Andy Warhol. And Andy Warhol would arrive on the first of the month every year at every apartment, at every loft, to collect the rent. So you'd hear the bell go off, and there would be Andy Warhol with his hand out. I mean, that's what he did. You know, he loved to wander. So, yes, you would see him everywhere.
Yeah. What are some of the restaurants downtown that come to mind? I mean, with food, did you go to food?
Oh, food, definitely.
Yeah, tell me about that, because I mean, firsthand experience of food, there's very few that remember it, and you have such a great way of description. Tell us about food.
Well, was it on Spring Street?
I think it was Spring.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, it was on Spring Street. It was one of the first places to kind of have a kind of casual, playful air about food. I think it was eventually closed by some sort of food poisoning or hepatitis or something. But yeah, it was a kind of a ptomaine kind of place. You couldn't go there really unless you had paint splattered blue jeans and were wearing a smock or something. Or it was, and you know, Finelli's was another place that was downtown.
Yep.
Where you would see people all the time. Because in those days, Soho, man, it was just a bunch of broken down, cast iron fronted buildings with people living in them. And I first went there in 1974. And I thought the Houston Street was like the northern verge of New York City.
Yeah.
I didn't really realize that there was even a Midtown.
What an amazing way to discover New York with that as your parameter. It's pretty fascinating. And, you know, it's interesting. Finelli now has been a scene for half a decade with a Gen Z crowd. I mean, very much fashion crowd, but Gen Z. Have you made it back to Finelli?
It was a mainstay. It was one of the few places that stayed open all during the pandemic.
It did.
And people were in there eating too, because, you know, there's a story to be written about the places that turned their back on the pandemic and just went on life as usual. To us, it was all, oh, we can't ever go inside and eat again. We have to eat outside. We have to carry out. We have to have delivery. But the fact of the matter is there were a bunch of restaurants that stayed open, and that was one of them. Unfortunately, the food is mediocre, but then it was possible to not be obsessed with food back then.
Yeah.
You could eat food for nourishment and pleasure without it being the most beautiful thing you've ever seen in your life.
Think about it too, without social, and to your point, which I agree fully, you know, pre-social, you have a meal and the stakes are much lower because you kind of don't know what you're walking into. And if your palate isn't like finely tuned, you're honestly just enjoying the meal because you have people around you like, and the meal might not be the center of it. You know, fast forward to today, and like, you know exactly every dish that you're going to order, what's good, what's really good, what's really bad.
And what's even worse, what it's going to look like.
That too.
And it will always look the same every time because they're like consciously making it look like the Instagram.
I know. It's funny.
It's weird because in many ways, social media have taken down food journalism too. I mean, not that it didn't deserve to be taken down, but people in Zoomers, Generation Z people, I would think I would never bother to read like a review or a,
I know.
Or an article about food. They want to just look all the time at TikTok and I mean, which is fine.
Yeah.
But all of their nourishment quite literally is coming from pictures of food.
Yeah. I would say some of the generation are maybe dismissing writing, but it's more challenging than ever. Your point is so taken. We both work in this world where we write stories on a weekly basis and we spend a lot of time with words, and it's frustrating in a way when folks aren't really reading what we're writing and they care more about the social video. I'm hopeful that if you find your audience, it might not be as big as it was in 2005, but if you find a couple thousand people who read your stuff weekly, that's enough to work. I mean, people read your stuff at Eater, I'd imagine.
They do, but even more important, Eater is in a constellation of publishing things that, I mean, Eater is even making like pots and pans now and stuff like that. So, you know, it has to be part of a whole suite of things that include social media and include videos and include, you know, wine clubs and every other thing, you know, because all of the old dinosaur glossy magazines, they're gone. They're other than Food and Wine.
Yeah.
You know,
BA's still around. They're trying. Savour just came back. Got to shout them out.
Savour, they may have come back, but I mean, I remember when Savour was anathema to the freelancer because you could write an article and maybe 3 years later it would come out for you.
A funny peek behind the curtain of Savour.
Sorry.
Absolutely true. I believe I wrote a piece once for Savour Print. I did not hear back. I was paid. I did not hear back for 10 months.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. You're probably the same. All right. We can talk about current media all day, but I do want to go back and talk about Down the Hatch a little bit. And first off, you know, what inspired you to write this zine? And what were you responding to when you were writing these, you know, thousands of words each month? Stapled together, colorful paper, set up the scene a little bit about Down the Hatch, the formation of it, and what you're responding to.
Oh, sure. I was in a rock band called Mofungo, M-O-F-U-N-G-O, and we did a lot of gigging and were kind of successful in a very small way.
Yeah.
And I used to go to this place called See Here, which was run by this guy named Ted Gottfried. It was like a mecca for the counterculture. It was downstairs, and he had all of these fanzines, rock fanzines by the zillions from every little city. He was very aggressive about, you know, if you were curious what was happening in the Vancouver music scene, you would go there, and there would often be two or three different fanzines priced at a dollar or two apiece, all of them crudely put together. And you could just, it was like the world of rock all in one like little basement room.
You could get Big Takeover, you get Comet Bus, you could get Venus.
Oh, good list.
Those are later journals. You could get Maximum Rock.
Chemical Imbalance.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Punk Planet, we can't forget about Punk Planet.
Oh, my God, yes. And even kind of slightly above ground things like New York Rocker,
which was
like a tabloid newspaper that covered the New York rock scene in a microscopic way almost. It was astonishing. So I saw these and I was influenced by them. My parents gave my daughter, she was like 5 or 6 years old, they gave her a computer. Nobody had computers at home, barely had them in offices, and we had no idea what to do with it. So what I did with it was to make a fanzine along the lines of a rock fanzine about food, about my adventures, especially in the outer boroughs, writing these kind of like stream of consciousness pieces about, you know, it could be, you know, a bar that served Ecuadorian food or a vending establishment, a lady on the street who was making doses or something like that. I mean, there were just so many things to be covered.
The beauty of reading them as a collection, which I've been able to do, is there's like callbacks. So you get to like reference previous issues like checking in on the Korean restaurant right across from Port Authority in 1992 when you were writing about Korean restaurants in Manhattan, you know, as early as anyone, really. And what I love about digging into Down the Hatch is, like, you know, these are all gone. Literally, this is like ancient history, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's I had no idea that it would be like some sort of permanent record. I mean, more of interest to anthropologists than foodies, I'm sure. So.
Priceless. I mean, I'm blessed with the copies. And let me ask you, when you're putting together the zine, how are you getting the word out? And how is your subscription list going and growing? And how are you putting it out each week? And how are you laying it out?
I was very influenced by conceptual art, which later morphed into performance art. So to me, deliberately doing artistic things and pretending that they aren't art is kind of all part of it. So I would be at my work, and I did a bunch of odd jobs. You know, in those days, you worked only to eat. Yeah. And to live and to pay your rent and stuff. You didn't have career opportunities or objectives.
I mean, Slacker Generation, Gen X.
Oh, yeah,
this
yeah.
is like the trademark.
Oh, absolutely. So I would work at these like awful jobs. I worked for Pfizer for a while as a kind of a freelance typist. And I worked for a whole bunch of different kind of like publishing companies. Sometimes I worked for Hachette as a photo editor for a while, but none of them amounted to a hill of beans. Mm-hmm. And so what they were good for, though, was they had Xerox machines that were state of the art. If anyone out there that doesn't remember what a Xerox machine, also known as a photocopier, it was the thing the size of a small car, where you would feed the paper and it would produce at like 30 copies a second a facsimile made of colored powders.
I mean, older listeners are like, think this is dripping with irony, but like younger listeners are like, huh, that sounds interesting.
I'm only explaining it because I've had many colleagues ask me what a Xerox was or whatever, because to them it's, you know, it means nothing. But for me, it was a way of reproducing what I was doing as a fanzine. I laid it out on the computer with the crude graphic tools into columns. I printed it at home, and then I went, I sometimes would buy or sometimes steal colored paper. That was another fad. Yeah. And I would, whatever kind of colored paper I would find in the Xerox room, there was a place called the Xerox room. Yeah. And I would like reproduce like 300, 400 copies or something, and then I would staple them together.
Very neatly stapled, I must say. You had a really good stapling technique.
Thank you so much.
You know, owning like 50 copies, I can see you cared about the staple, the placement. It had to be right.
I was a little anal back then, perhaps. Yeah.
Respect. So how are you growing your audience? How are you getting the word out? And who's subscribing to Down the Hatch? I know you likely had some famous-ish people subscribing.
Oh, God, yes. But what I did was I originally established, these were all mailed. There was no internet.
No.
So I would make these things. It might be like cherry red and maybe two other colors. I would staple them together. I sent them to all of my rock friends because the whole purpose of this, among other things, was to provide something to do between your sound check when you were in a band and could be playing just about anywhere, between your sound check and when you went on at 2 a.m, there were hours when you could travel to another restaurant. You didn't have much money. You wanted to eat. You wanted to eat something fun and interesting and cheap. And so that's the whole purpose of that. And but perversely, I also would send copies to all of the editors at publications that I read just to kind of kick their asses for not featuring this kind of food. I mean, I both wanted them to start reporting on this, and I probably secretly wanted them to hire me.
Yeah, of course you wanted. It was a little bit of a resume. Are we talking like Grimes? Are we talking about Reuschel? Are we talking about who are you sending them to?
I can tell you who I didn't send them to. One day I got a scratchy phone call from Los Angeles, someone who in a halting sort of way asked if I would send it to him. And I told him that I didn't think that it was too hard. I spent too much time folding and stapling and mailing things, and that I didn't think that anyone in California needed to hear about. And of course, this is in the early 90s, and it was Jonathan Gold, who I later became close friends with. But
I remember seeing the two of you together at a couple parties, and it was fun to have a conversation with the two of you together.
I sent it to The Voice. I sent it to the critics. I send them to Ruth Reichel. I send them a whole bunch of people. And I was proud to be like covering this beat.
Yeah.
And I felt like what I was doing was sufficient. I had no dreams of being a professional food writer or a professional writer at all. I mean,
you didn't think of yourself as a critic or a writer at that time?
Oh, not at all.
More of a fan.
More of a kind of a crazy in the closet artist making these like weird little things.
But they were very detailed. I mean, one issue, and I will have you back to talk in detail about Under Down the Hatch, but you did a whole Portugal issue, which was great. It was like your vacation to Portugal.
The beauty of that was, thank you so much. Yeah. The beauty of that was that I could write about anything I wanted.
Yeah.
Period. And if I went to Portugal, I would like write about it. If I went to Africa, I would write about it. If I went to someplace different than what you expected, I would write about it. And what else? That was just, it was empirical. It was what was in front of me. I wasn't like sitting there thinking, how can I get a thousand extra hits and run up the traffic by putting this pizza in here or doing whatever.
But I mean, it was a reason to dine out. I mean, you're working these jobs, you're making a living to pay the rent, but you're also have a monthly deadline. And you clearly, the reason you're so successful in food writing is obviously your ethic. I mean, you have a work ethic. You really want to drive and get down. Would you write every night and then collect it once a month? I mean, it's coming out monthly. And we're talking probably 5,000 words an issue, maybe 8,000 words.
It's a fair amount, but, you know, it almost that amount in today's climate, at least for a web writer, seems laughable.
Sure.
I can remember when I first worked at The Voice, I would produce one review a week.
Yeah,
that was considered the typical workload for a professional full-time writer. And I frankly don't remember what I did with all that time because, you know, as I continued to do it as a job and as the demands of the web ballooned, you know, I can remember Amanda Clute, who was one of the founders of Eater. Yeah. She told me that when she first worked there, she was required to do 10 posts per day.
Yep.
And all I can say is I'm really, I was in on the ground floor with the Village Voices website, and I wrote a lot for that. Later, Gourmet started a website, and all the writers were like crying about, oh, I'm not going to get paid enough, and I don't want to do this. This cheapens the writing or whatever. And I'm going like, no, I want to do this.
Yeah, because you have the metabolism. You have a high metabolism for restaurants, and you want to get the word out. And that's what a true journalist and writer wants, is to get the word out. Let's actually talk about The Voice. You had established that you had sent the Down the Hatch issues to the editor there. How did you end up getting a job there? Did you have a desk at that old Cooper Square building? Were you, I mean, these weekly columns were well read. I mean, The Voice was read by everyone in New York.
I know. And I look back on those days kind of longingly because, and did it with Gourmet, that, you know, you wrote something and yes, it would end up in a stack in somebody's summer house, but people actually saw your writing. A lot more people, I'm sure most of them kind of like were on the subway, like paging through the Village Voice, and they would like read the first three words and go on to the next article or whatever. Fine with me. Because now, you know, your readers are counted in the thousands and tens of thousands rather than in the millions.
Yeah.
The Village Voice had a circulation of, I don't know, in, well, Gourmet, it was like 3 million,
yeah,
I think.
Gourmet had a lot more, but then The Voice.
The Voice had 500,000 or something.
A city, you know, restaurants in this packed city, when they got The Voice call out from you, I mean, they instantly became hits. You were a hit maker.
And that was great. I mean,
so
that's
great.
No longer really true, but it was really, really fun. When I first started working there, I went in to see Jonathan Larson. Now, what had happened was that Michael Weinstein, the previous critic there, He and a wonderful union activist and a really great guy. He went off to 6 months to Australia or something, and they asked me. He was the one that recommended that I take over for him, not my wonderful editor Robert Christgau, who was like a rock writer.
He was your editor. He top.
He was my
you?
Editor. Yeah, he, it's amazing. He was an amazing editor. He taught me. I mean, I've learned so much from every one of my editors, and they've changed my attitude toward writing. And he was great. The way he edited was he wanted to be with you in person, which was my real contact with The Voice in a way.
So great. Called you in the office.
No, he usually just did it at home, but it could be the office too. And he would just sit there and he would just take things out. He would he took things out. He changed other things. He switched them around, but he did it really fast. And I was like, it was a revelation that you should mercilessly go over your own work in that sort of way.
And it's a great lesson. Are you guys still in touch?
When our daughters had a falling out, they were 13 years old. We never saw each other after that, other than the occasional passing of the street or something. It shows, I'm sure you've experienced this before too, that you could have a professional relationship that was fruitful and warm and productive, and then like all of a sudden it just stopped.
The personal stuff can end,
It's like an office fling or something.
Yeah, it's an office relationship.
When I'd gone in for the first time, which was in like 1993 to first do the column, Jonathan Larson had told me that he didn't want me in the office because they couldn't afford a desk or a chair. And so I was one of the first people in what became known as the electronic cottage.
That's the report from
home. And, you know, it was the modem that made this possible. Yeah. This is before even the internet, but you would send your copy in, you know, over that phone thing that went.
And you probably had New York Online, which was the New York version of America Online?
I'm not sure if I did, but I definitely, there were, but that was the great days of the bulletin board, like Jim Leff and Chowhound.
Yes.
I was very active on that. And that and was another way that you used the budding internet before the web became available.
We will have you back. And really, I want to talk about your Eater days. And I want to talk about your career in general, Robert, you're welcome back anytime. I want to close this section and talk about your Essential Pizzerias writing in New York.
You
just updated it in the past couple weeks, and I love the list. I align with you in most of the picks, but give me your top three right now in New York pizzerias.
Well, now and forever, John's of Bleecker Street, one of the original coal oven places. I mean, my daughter was pretty much raised there under the hideous mural of the Blue Grotto, which looks like it was painted by a three-year-old,
right.
Which is fine. I mean, I love it, but
just you got to stop by. Got to go there.
It's great. It's coal oven pizza. You can see them delivering the coal in the morning from the coal truck, which is a complete anachronism and probably anti-ecological. But and then I love that Mama's Two, which is up on the Upper West Side, but a new
upper West Side.
Upper West Side, maybe about 103rd and Broadway.
Great place.
They've just opened a new place. I haven't been to it. It's down on Bleecker Street at Christopher. Another is Lou and Ernie's, which is in Schuylerville, Bronx, which is in a white frame house, and they're really famous for their kind of garlicky white slice.
Yeah.
They only make pizzas. They don't make salads. You know, it's just a fantastic, it's a
charm.
Is
it to go only?
No. You can sit there.
You can sit down
in that
house.
Yeah.
It's new to me.
I prefer the sit-down places. It's wonderful. If you can get there, do so.
I was really excited. There was a place right by our office at like 52nd and 8th.
Uh-huh.
What is that place? Do you remember that?
52nd.
There's the place over, it's like, or it's over.
Oh, Don's Dorita.
Yeah, you called it out.
Oh, that is a fantastic place.
I love it.
It's one of a new crop, relatively new crop of chefs actually coming here from Naples.
And it's Neapolitan style, exactly.
Da Michele in the West Village is another version of a place where, but the problem is if you've been to the original place in Naples and you go there, they've completely transformed the restaurant and put in like fancy stuff and wine lists and stuff. You know what they drink with pizza in Naples.
I mean, I would think half Chianti, half Coca-Cola.
Coca-Cola, definitely.
Yeah. Maybe throw a little Chianti in the Coca-Cola.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they have a couple of bubbly wines from Sorrento. Cold red bubbles is what they drink. So.
Yeah. Naples, I've been to Naples. I'm going back in October with Mauricio Leo.
Oh, great.
On a Taste Travels. We're doing a trip there. And absolutely essential to kind of connect New York and Naples in these restaurants. And I love your pizza list. You put F&F on there, right?
What's F&F?
Or maybe we did. Oh, you put L&B Spumoni, but F&F is the Franks on Court Street, Lower Carroll Gardens.
Oh, yeah. That's been on there, but it's been on and off. The thing is, I revise that list a couple times a year.
I love it.
And I take some off, put some on.
So F&F is...
L&B Spumoni Gardens is always
great.
Please.
Yeah. That's my...
Although
that's
people hate it because it's kind of like uncooked in the middle.
People hate that place because they don't know. And it's a very specific pizza, but I think that's great pizza with a point of view. Is my number one pizza. And I think F&F, I love the way they do the sourdough, and that's a really, really great bread there.
Oh, yeah.
And then you've got L&B Spumoni, doughy in the middle, sweet sauce, square slices.
And let's not even mention the wonderful pizzas of Staten Island, where it is grown in isolation.
It is. And if you can make it out of Staten Island, which one is it? That's Chicago shit. What is the one?
There's Lee's Tavern. Is a place that does bar pizzas.
Yeah, that's the one. Lee's.
And the whole idea of a bar pizza is it has a kind of a crisp crust, so you can hold it while you're drinking a beer.
I love it.
And they're small, so that they also have big ones. But you know, they have clam pies. Just they have amazing pizzas.
Robert, and this is Taste. We ask guests about their discerning taste. So to close this interview, here's a little rapid fire, fast and furious taste check. Are you ready?
Let me get my list up. I have it on my phone.
You cribbed it. I love it. You came ready. You came
to
play.
I think I could have done it from memory, but we'll see.
Yeah. Okay. The best fruit.
Tomato.
I feel that works. We try to avoid the technicalities, but that's fine. The worst vegetable.
I like papaya, too.
Yeah. Papaya is a good one if it's good. What about the worst vegetable?
Frozen peas.
Ooh, baby. Really?
Yeah.
Dang. But you like canned peas and fresh peas?
Yeah, oh yeah.
But frozen, okay. I'm into it. The best dessert?
The French flan that comes in a crust.
Yeah. Oh my God. Such a good call. Your favorite American fast food chain?
Whataburger.
What is that one? I know
the
name.
It's a Texas-based chain where they put, God help us, mustard instead of mayo and red or some special sauce on there, and it's great.
Ugh. I love the idea that mustard is working in a burger because I can't tell you in one example where it does, but I believe you.
You would love it. You want to go to Texas?
We have hung out in Texas. Do you recall? You and I.
Oh, my God. I forgot
that.
Remember
we drove around Texas, the hill country, went and had some barbecue?
Oh, my God.
South by Southwest, like 2011.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Okay. A few more. Your favorite New York City restaurant right now?
Sky Pavilion.
Yeah. Love it. Your favorite cookbook of all time?
Joy of Cooking.
Your favorite new cookbook discovery?
Food of the Italian Islands.
Oh, Katie Parla, shout out. Love that.
Yeah, yeah, it's great.
Your favorite album right now?
This is an old one, Sufjan Stevens, Illinois.
Yeah, right? Now the basis of a show at the Armory.
Which I saw.
Oh, wow. So now it comes, and it comes to life for you.
It's all, it comes to life. Of course, there's one John Wayne Gacy song, and that doesn't quite come
that
to life.
That song is devastating.
It's creepy, yeah, creepy.
That song comes on the radio once in a while in Sirius. It's a beautiful song. What a master. I love Sufjan Stevens. Your favorite city outside America to visit for food?
Dakar, Senegal.
I love that. A cuisine you would like to learn more about?
Guatemalan.
Have you been?
No.
Yeah.
I've been to Mexico, but I haven't been to Guatemala.
Robert, let's get that travel story going.
I know, but I haven't forgotten that they were killing those nuns about 25 years ago, so.
Yeah. Would you go, though?
I would go, yeah.
I think, listen, editors, get Robert down to Guatemala to write some stories. Last one, your favorite sandwich?
Mortadella and focaccia.
Is there a place in New York that does it?
Is there? Just about anywhere that sells focaccia, but there's this new English, British coffee chain. I forget the name, at the corner of 7th Avenue South and right below Christopher, about a block and a half, that only has oat milk in their coffee, but they also make these little thin sandwiches with mortadella and focaccia.
It's such a great combo. What a great call. We haven't had that on the show. Robert, this has been such a pleasure. Please come back. Thank you so much for joining This Is Taste.
Thanks for having me. That was big fun.
We played in Grand Rapids.
Yeah, Grand Rapids.
At, what's the place called? Pyramid Scheme.
Pyramid Scheme, yeah.
And Kalamazoo.
Kalamazoo.
I can't actually say Kalamazoo anymore. I have another friend from there. I told her that we do that.
We got to keep this in, Clayton. We're keeping this full. And Luke Pyenson, thank you so much for joining this taste. How are you, buddy?
Great. How are you?
I'm good. It's nice to meet you. And yeah, you wrote a great feature for Taste, and we'll talk about that. We're talking about my hometown, Kalamazoo, but you call it Kalamazoo.
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 As if there were two Z's at the end, as if it were an Italian, as if it were like a coastal Italian village, Kalamazoo.
I'm super into that. And you ended up going to the famous Sweetwater Donuts.
Yeah. On tour, people are always trying to get us to eat donuts. And if you ate a donut every time someone said you have to go to this donut place, you know, you would be eating too many donuts.
Do you fuck with donuts? Do you like them as a food?
Honestly, I don't love donuts, but Sweetwater's is great. It's just, it's old fashioned. It's just no nonsense. And I have a fond memory of Sweetwater's in Kalamazoo.
Kalamazoo. They do the cake style and agree hard about the donut. I'll go Queen Amon over donut.
Yeah, I'd go just about anything over a donut. But you know where they make nice donuts is Aggie's Counter. They have the Hungarian style donuts on weekends. Funk, I think they're called. Really delightful.
Cool place. We're going to talk about your Menu Hotlines piece for Taste, and it was a terrific piece, and I'll link to it. But let's first get into your two loves, which is food / journalism and music. What came first?
No, one didn't come before the other.
Yeah.
It was
simultaneous.
Contemporaneous, yeah. I started taking drum lessons when I was 8 years old.
Yeah.
And then I started interning in restaurant kitchens when I was about 13. So, you know, in terms of doing them, like, kind of pursuing them more seriously, that was, I guess, music maybe came first.
Yeah.
But they've always been kind of like both competing and complementary interests for basically my whole life.
Well, being 13 in the back of a kitchen, we'll get to that. But let's get into your drumming career. You were telling me off mic, you're retired. You're 33 and retired.
That's about the time I think is generally good to start thinking about retirement.
You were the drummer of Frankie Kosmos. You had bands in the Boston area.
Yep.
You were able to tour a lot, and you have a book that's coming out soon. It's called Tasty Music. We'll get to that at some point. But when you tour and you're thinking about food, Luke, what are you trying to do here?
Well, I mean, there are different stages of my career, right? So at the beginning, when I was going to a lot of these places for the first time, it was like, I have to have the regional specialty. I have to go to this place. I came into every town with an agenda. And then as I got older, and we're talking older, like my late 20s, it was like, what can I eat that's going to make me feel good and not awful every day? And it's hard to find that. It's hard to find that balance.
Well, the polarity of touring, and I've known plenty of touring musicians and used to write about music before food back in the day, and you know, bless you for doing both. It's cool that you have both. You remind me of my friend Nils Bernstein.
Yeah.
Does both, and you know Nils as well. But I feel there's a polarity with food and touring. It's like either Taco Bell or you're splurging. You're going to that one meal on the off day. You're in San Francisco and you're going to Zuni, you know, for example. Is that true, or is there more of a middle when you're touring?
Well, yeah, you put it really well. That is true. But the middle is more, that's more your bread and butter. The middle is more your everyday experience of being on tour. The poles totally exist. But I did. I went to Cafe Chez Panisse once when we played in Berkeley. Nice. You can't do that every time. It's mostly just trying to dial in what makes you feel good and what's going to make. Ultimately, you're on the road to perform, so it's about, you know, having your body feel good, your mind clear, and just feeling like light and ready to go. And that's not always the best restaurant or, you know, the most kind of coveted regional specialty is not always going to make you feel like that.
Definitely not. I feel like you're definitely going to feel a little bit let in if you're doing, even like, you know, you're doing a Bronzino, but you're eating all the sides, and then you got the bread course, and then you got like obviously you got pasta thrown in, you got this like dessert.
I've made some really bad mistakes.
Tell me about them. What are the mistakes that you've made on tour?
So this is one of my favorite restaurants in the universe, L'Express in Montreal.
Yeah.
Such a fantastic restaurant. Lauren, my wife and bandmate, and I went there before a gig in Montreal in like 2018. And I want to say she had steak tartare and fries. like a huge plate, a really like a big plate of
ramen. It's like brasserie style.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's like a 24-hour brasserie in Montreal. It's really like, it's such a great restaurant. And I had, so my favorite dish there is this like quail with wild rice, kind of a demi-glace type sauce. Mm-hmm. It's so delicious. And then a
demi-glace is not hitting light.
It's not light food. No. And then a huge, like imagine the biggest eel flottant you can imagine with like this caramel crust and candied almonds. And eel flottant is fairly light, but when it's the size I'm talking about here and I'm showing you with my hands, it's like the size of like a huge dome of meringue with this caramel. And the creme anglaise is not super light, actually.
It's not.
To start. Like we had a lot of food.
Yeah, a creme anglaise to end and then you got to play a show?
That's right.
Okay.
Not a good show.
Tell me about that show.
Well, yeah, it just felt so horrible and heavy. And I mean, the meal was great, but there's a time and a place. And right,
I mean, you're the drummer, so you've got
sitting.
You got backdraft.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you know what I mean. So you're good. But is Lauren singing backup?
Yes, she is in the front. She's standing. She's singing backup. When you're singing, there's a lot that you kind of tend to be careful about eating. Dairy. Crème anglaise.
Crème anglaise.
Yeah.
Crème anglaise. Ina Garten once told me this is not supposed to be a name drop. She literally told me this on Zoom once when I was interviewing her. Crème anglaise is basically Häagen-Dazs vanilla melted down.
Yeah.
It's like the easiest way to do it anyways, and aside. So that didn't work out.
Yeah.
Alcohol and shows. I always am amazed when artists can consume alcohol and then go play a show.
Yeah, I basically didn't. I did my best to really not drink that much on tour. My whole band was pretty monastic about that.
Yeah.
And I think it helped us kind of stay as healthy as possible on the road and stay focused on what we were there to do. And it's not, I think it's kind of a stereotype that musicians drink heavily. I mean, clearly musicians sometimes have a drink on the road.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to say they don't, but we certainly weren't the only ones that we knew who were teetotalers on the road.
Very smart and very professional. I was out with Tom and Mo from Black Moth Super Rainbow, a friend
of
mine.
I haven't heard that band name in a while.
Ill,
oh, I used to love that. Yeah.
You should love them always.
It's been a while. It was just, that was like college.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those guys are amazing.
Super
and
good.
My friend Steve plays in their band and they were on tour. I remember once, this was maybe a decade ago, longer. We went to Mother's Ruin, and I watched Homeboy. He like drank like 5 frozen drinks, and then just played the illest show. I was like, "This guy," and I was like, "Wow."
Well, look, everyone has their, you know, you got to know what's gonna make you play the best show, and
yeah,
there were times when like you know a beer before a show or like a glass of wine, and I would be feeling good, especially if I like hadn't eaten that much. When you're just that right level of like. But it depends on the vibe of the venue, the crowd size. Like, there's so many variables.
So many. And what about weed in shows? Because that's the other thing I always wonder. Do you participate in like a little bit of weed here and there?
I kind of strictly don't at all.
Yeah.
Just in my life. But and not only that, I was kind of a like people did not like this about me. If people were smoking at our shows, I would sometimes. Say on the mic, like, please stop smoking weed during our shows.
Yeah, I think it affects the singers.
It affects the singers. Yeah. I don't like the smell, to be totally honest. That's such a square thing to say.
No, it's not.
I like to be comfortable when I'm on stage. And like, if anything, it's the same as flash photography, honestly. If someone starts smoking during a show, it's like as disruptive to me as someone taking a flash photo. Yeah.
No, it's not square. I hate the smoke.
It's like inside, you know? If it's an outdoor show, fine.
Fair.
But an indoor show... Yeah.
Luke, this got a little fratty. It's on me. We were just talking about, hey man, do you smoke weed before a show? I don't want this interview to go there because I want to hear about when you were 13 and you're living in Newton, Massachusetts and you end up interning and working at a restaurant. What is this job? It sounds like you probably saw some shit.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I would say it quite like that. But yeah, I started staging at a place called Via Mata that's not there anymore. The chef is named Michael Schlau. He was one of our like local celeb chefs at the time. It was a really, so this was like 2004, I think, is when I started. It was kind of the like hotspot Italian place in Boston. And I don't know, New Yorkers maybe like scoff at the place in Boston. But it was a fantastic restaurant. I learned so much. And I would go in on Saturday nights, like instead of hanging out with my friends, I would go in. And it's not like I was working the line, but I would just kind of float around and whoever wanted to basically... show me what they were up to.
So let me, were you putting in prep? Were you doing garde manger? Were you serving?
I would come in like during the day and do prep. I did a lot of like dessert garde manger, helping the pastry chef. Yeah. That was kind of like an easy place where I wasn't in too many people's way.
Yeah.
And then gradually I started doing more. And by the time I was, I think early college, I would do garde manger, like fully on the line garde manger.
That's cool. So you ended up working at this restaurant?
Summers. Yeah.
Nice. Were there any other chef restaurant or chef jobs that you did yourself?
Yeah. Well, yeah. The most recent chef cooking job. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll strike that. You are not a chef. You are a
certainly
cook.
Not. If yes. anyone ever says that, I correct them.
No. And I'm being.
And not only that, I was a prep cook, a pasta prep cook, fresh pasta at a place called Giulia in Cambridge. That's GIU, which is still there and fantastic. That was in 2013. So I would go in and make pasta during the day, and then that's when I was kind of more active in Boston's DIY music scene.
Yeah.
And so, play shows at night.
So yeah. Then your second love kicked in a little bit.
Well, so this is why like AM pasta cook was kind of the only thing I could do, because that's why I said earlier they're like competing interests, right? Because if you're playing shows at night, you can't be on the line dinner service. So it's kind of it's hard to maintain careers in both like restaurant cooking and music. So music won out, and then journalism was a good way to kind of like stay involved in the food world without working in kitchens.
Yeah.
And then obviously I want to be really kind to my body. So going on tour, you know, pick something less stressful than a kitchen, going on tour.
Going on tours, so it's super less stressful. Did you ever go to Craigie on Main? You ever go to that restaurant?
Yeah, a while ago. Oh yeah, sure.
I want to give that a little shout out. I think Tony Mons is such a talented guy, and I had a call with him over the pandemic, but I haven't talked to Tony in a while.
Poor guy is one of those chefs that his burger got really popular, and then no one wanted to eat like
his great like other food salads because, and his fresh like doing fresh pastas. Yeah.
And an early like nose to tail practitioner in Boston.
Agreed.
Before it was fashionable.
What else did you go to growing up in Boston? What were restaurants that you love in?
Well, you know what, and it's still there. It opened in 2001. Oleana.
Yeah.
Cambridge is
definitely
so ahead of its time. I mean, she, Anna Sortoon, the chef, was using Middle Eastern and Eastern Mediterranean ingredients before they were fashionable at all. Mm-hmm. And it's still as good as it always was. It's such a good place.
So you studied in college, and then you have a graduate degree as well, tourism, but like the academic side of it. And you become fluent in four languages, with Arabic being one of them. And you speak a couple dialects. And I mean, how does language fluency help you as a food writer? I think it's tremendous, and you're very humble about this. I had to pull this out of your bio, by the way. It wasn't like you're telling people about this stuff.
I try not to tell people.
You don't. I mean, you don't. You're a humble guy. I'm just like, this is my job to interview you. But tell me, like, are there moments when you're fluency in Italian and French and Spanish and Arabic?
Yeah,
those four.
I mean, and I want to say, like, it's a spectrum, fluency.
Sure,
and
of
like
course.
You know, sometimes I'm rustier than other times.
Yeah, you got to practice it. But you're a linguist, obviously. However, give me some examples of times when maybe you were in a space where, you know, your language skills kind of helped you see something that maybe I would not see.
Well, it's really come in handy in homestays, and like, so I did a semester in Morocco undergrad. Then my graduate field work was in the West Bank, and I stayed with host families in both of those situations. And English was not really spoken in either of those. And in Morocco, I could kind of fall back on French a little bit, but I really had, if I wanted to kind of poke my nose in the kitchen and see what was going on, like I had to communicate in Arabic. And if I hadn't been able to, I would have missed out on so much. I mean, even just simple questions like, hey, what are you putting in right there, you know, or what's this dish called?
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. So it really opened up a lot of doors in that way. And the homestay experience, and you know, you can do this as a tourist, you don't have to be a student, is just, it's incredible. I mean, it's an incredible way to kind of have a deeper dive into a cuisine.
Yeah, so are homestays part of like an exchange program, or is it just part of a loose collective? You just stay with a host family for X amount of time?
In Morocco, it was just like, it was part of the program. Semester abroad I was doing. In the
cool.
West Bank, it was a tourism group called ATG, the Alternative Tourism Group, and they match you with host families, and you can kind of choose how long you stay, and it's a really cool organization.
I'd love to hear about the West Bank, your time there. How long ago was this? Were you staying there?
10 years ago.
Great.
Yeah.
And where? What parts? What city?
The host family was in Beit Sahur, which is outside Bethlehem. And I did research there and in Ramallah and Nablus and Hebron.
What do you take away from living in the West Bank, spending considerable amount of time there?
Yeah, well, I didn't live there, but I was there. I did, you know, about 2-3 weeks of field research there, so I don't want to give the wrong impression.
Right.
But just being, I mean, it's such a hospitable culture. It's beautiful culture, beautiful food, incredible, friendly, gracious, humble people.
Yeah.
And I mean, I wish it were an easier place to travel to, and obviously I wish what is going on in the region was not going on. It's heartbreaking. And the only kind of positive I can see is that people are really showing an interest in the food from that part of the world and supporting Palestinian restaurants and food personalities. And, you know, when I moved to New York 10 years ago, shortly after this experience, there weren't that many places to get Palestinian food. And now there are. There's so many, and it's been so cool to see.
Yeah, the boom in Palestinian restaurants in South Brooklyn, parts of Queens.
Really a boom, and not just that, but like a boom in people's just like literacy and what Palestinian food is and what separates it from other Levantine cuisines.
Yeah. Let me ask you about your favorite place for Levantine cuisine. I mean, it's a very broad term, right? And I'd love to just get your, Luke, your picks around New York.
Tannerine. I mean, I love Tannerine.
It's an old school place.
Yeah, I think it's so fantastic. Their moussachen, which is like the national dish of Palestine, I think is the best. Yeah. It's so good. And she does like shredded chicken rather than a whole quarter, and I prefer that.
Yeah.
It's so good. And the kanafa is outstanding there.
Great kanafa. Oh my. There's a place in Park Slope that does a kanafa that I find quite good. It's like on 3rd Avenue, it's called like tahini.
Oh, tahini.
Tahini.
With a E.
Yeah.
I walk past that all the time.
So
I've never been there.
Kanafa there slaps.
Okay.
It's really good kanafa.
Oh, good to know.
Yeah, yeah. Absolute great dish that you bring up. Yeah, that place with the good spelling. It's so true.
Yeah.
It's a random question. I was watching a video. You were talking about food on tour. Why are red bell peppers associated with Prague? Because you said you know you're in Prague if there's red bell peppers.
I said that.
You did, I believe.
Oh, you know, I think I was talking about
I said that. Well,
yeah,
I got
like the green room, like green room spreads.
Yeah.
I think Central Europe in general, I mean, and the Czech Republic, when you're looking at that spread, there's always going to be very heavy bell pepper presence in the crudité.
Do you like that? Is that a positive?
You know, I don't like raw bell peppers.
Yeah.
I like bell peppers. Raw is kind of, I'm not interested in that.
As a sofrito, it's pretty great.
Yeah.
You know, cook it down, put it in a sauce. You can make it into a great type of harissa or something.
Mm-hmm.
Shakshuka, but not raw. I'm with you.
Not raw.
With that.
Lecho, a Hungarian dish, which I wrote a recipe for and an article about, I love. And that's like basically just cooked down bell peppers and sausage, and that's really good.
Yeah. I'd love to talk to you a little bit more about the touring, about food on the road. I guess first question, when you were working with labels and industry people, were there, did you ever get taken out on the road to a cool place? Ever happen?
Yeah. I mean, not really like, you know, recognizable restaurants,
but
it was more about like having the opportunity to travel to and play in really interesting places. I'm thinking of like Jakarta, for example. We were taken out to a Padang meal, which was incredible. And just like, I mean, I couldn't have really ever imagined that I would get to go there for music. And,
amazing.
Yeah.
Like that routing, when you saw that on like a spreadsheet or I got a call, that's a pretty cool place to visit.
Oh, I was like over the moon.
Yeah.
We played a festival there. And actually, so what happened is we got offered a festival in Jakarta. I looked at how to get there. And saw that, we were a Sky Team band.
Yeah.
So
I'm sorry, you weren't, you know, Sky Team's okay. I mean, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to take sides. I'm more of a Delta guy.
No, Delta is Sky Team.
Wait, I thought Sky Alliance. Oh, no.
Delta's, unless I'm mistaken.
You said Sky Team. I thought it was American, but I'm.
American is Star Alliance,
oh my
if
God.
I'm not mistaken,
you are,
and Delta is Sky Team.
You're getting it.
Yeah.
This is So great. I was like, how can you not be Delta in New York? Okay.
Yeah,
great.
Yeah. So anyway, the way to get the easiest way to get to Jakarta was via Seoul on Korean Air.
Yeah.
So I wrote to our booking agent immediately and was like, you think you could hook something up in Seoul? Stop there on the way to Jakarta. And that's exactly what happened.
I love it.
So that's another place where we were taken out we had lucky to have good friends there and they showed us around.
That's really cool. I just got back. I was there in January. So tell me, what was that like? What was your time in Seoul?
Oh, it was incredible. Well, it was, yeah. Well, we were interviewed on the Korean Public Broadcasting Network's radio, EBS, I want to say.
Right.
Which was super fun. And we just played this one club show in Hongdae, which was great.
Oh, so they routed you a show in Hongdae.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We weren't just going to, like, hang out.
No, I thought maybe you were, you played a show in Hongdae. Oh, cool.
Yeah, yeah. This was actually, like, the last tour I did before COVID. This was in December 2019.
Yeah.
And then my wife's really good friend from college is from Seoul and was living there with her mom. And we went over there for lunch and her mom cooked us this huge spread. And, it was just so memorable.
That's great. And then you moved on to Jakarta. And
then we went to Jakarta, played this festival. They took us. I mean, I was in a day. I was super jet lagged, in a complete daze. They took us for satay, like the first stop. Which
Amazing.
Is great. I had a friend from grad school who lives in Bandung, which is not far from Jakarta. So she flew over for the show, which was very nice of her. She took and she had grown up in Jakarta. So we had an afternoon with her where she showed us around like her childhood market.
Oh, and, fun.
Yeah. And then she took us for the padang meal along with the promoters of the festival.
That must have been so cool to actually be taken out by local.
Incredible.
Cool people.
Incredible.
Music people.
Yeah.
Did you go anywhere else after that tour? Were you in Southeast Asia hanging out?
I wish. No. And, because the pandemic was right after. So, of course, we were kicking ourselves. Like, we should have stuck around.
You never know.
Yeah. But no, we had to come home.
Best post-show meal, meaning it's memorable in that it doesn't look like the best food, but it was just like a memorable gathering post-show.
Well, I'm thinking about, we were talking about Middle Eastern food, and I think I have really fond memories of playing in Detroit. Every time we played in Detroit, we would make sure to stay in Dearborn, which is, of course, like the U.S.'s Arab majority city.
Yeah.
Amazing Arab food from all over the Arab world in Dearborn. And there was in my memory, it's a 24-hour drive-through Lebanese restaurant, but I'm not sure that it's 24-hour, but it definitely has a drive-through called Cedarland. And that was our ritual every time we played in Detroit. We would go to the Lebanese drive-through, load up on meze, and then eat it in bed in the Doubletree.
Oh, I know Cedar Tree. I know that place, absolutely. And Shatila as well for the bakery there.
Shatila
is great. I love. I mean, it's, and you got to put your language skills to work a little bit.
Yep, absolutely. I remember Kahwa House, the Yemeni coffee place, which now has locations in the city. There's like a few here.
It's cool.
But they started in Dearborn, and we went there in like 2018, 2019. Incredible coffee place, and they have all the Lebanese Yemeni sweets like sabaya, the flaky Nigella seed honey pastry. Incredible. And yeah, I remember the guy writing down like the names in Arabic for me, and good memories. Dearborn, Michigan.
Hospitable. Yeah.
Not far from Kalamazoo.
Kalamazoo is about a 2-hour drive. My sister lives in the north suburbs of Detroit, so I get to go there and enjoy some. I love Dearborn. It's great community there.
It's so cool.
I mean, let's talk about Taste in Music. It's your book. It's coming out in the fall. So, I mean, it's a great title, by the way.
Thank you.
It's a great title. I mean, it works in many levels.
Yeah, thanks. It's, you know what? I'm going to admit that I came up with it.
Yeah, you should. I always take credit. I came up with the Korea World. Plug in that right now, too.
Please.
It reminds me, did you ever read the Alex Kapranos, the dude from Franz Ferdinand? You ever read that book?
Of course. That was a Hanukkah present.
Yeah.
And I want to say, like, senior year of high school. And that, yeah, I got to give credit to Alex Kapranos, who declined to participate in our book.
Stop it.
Well, no, I don't mean to say it
dude's
like that.
Not
I'm just joking.
Sorry, you know? Dude's not busy.
Yeah, no.
Dude's not busy.
But he's a label mate of my co-author, so we thought like maybe he would want to chat. But no, that book is great. He had a Guardian column where he wrote about all the stuff he was eating on tour, and it was anthologized. And it was, I mean, at the time, I just couldn't think of anything cooler.
It's a very cool book.
Yeah.
He's a terrific writer. And then there's Alex James, the bassist from Blur.
Oh, the cheese guy.
The cheese guy.
Yeah.
Which I've heard unofficially that he doesn't really make his cheese, but he
really?
Does. Well,
that's...
He owns the cheese
thing.
Alex, come on the show. I've emailed your manager 3 times. Got one reply back. It was like three words. Love to have you on the show.
Like we're both having trouble with our respect.
Yeah, we're not
Alex's here.
we're not getting into the Alex in the UK music scene. I did get to interview Alex Kapranos once at Cafe Colonial on Houston back in the day for a magazine article. And lovely men. All they wanted to do was talk about Orange Juice the band, the Scottish band, great Scottish.
It's my wife's favorite band.
Really?
Oh yeah.
No shit. That I feel I like Belle and Sebastian if I'm going in that route, but I do like Orange Juice. Yeah. They're both great.
Mm-hmm.
Underrated place to do rock. Alex come on the show. Both Alexes, we can clear.
Well, and you're gonna get my co-author Alex Bleeker, who's an Alex that will happily engage.
He's a bassist in real estate.
He's the bassist in real estate. Yeah,
and they're still a band. Or
they're not only still a band; they just put out a new record a few weeks ago, which is slamming. Yeah,
yeah. I've always enjoyed those guys. What band? What label are they on?
Domino.
Oh, Domino Clinic. Home of Clinic. Remember that?
No, what is
that
Clinic?
Weird band with the surgical masks from the early 2000s?
Oh, it sounds like they were ahead of their time the masks.
Well said. They definitely were set up during the pandemic. Probably one of the lower tier Domino bands. Not sure why I just referenced them. We could talk about music all day. Sorry, listeners, that we went there. But tell me about Taste in Music. What's and the pre-order link will be in the show notes, so just check it out. Music and food are great when they mash together, but oftentimes they're done in kind of a hackneyed way. I've been able to look at the PDF. It's terrific writing and terrific booking of minds and souls. But what were you trying to do with this book?
I think like the kind of popular image of going on tour hasn't really been refreshed since like Almost Famous.
Yeah.
And that was not my experience. That's not most people's experience.
Yeah, I know.
And I think... Yeah, Alex and I were trying to find a way in, you know, to telling those stories, and food is a perfect way. So we started kind of talking to our musician friends about what they eat on the road, and it really just kind of took shape from there. I mean, we thought and confirmed that food stories were just a really great way to talk about going on tour in general. And so we're not only talking to, you know, quote unquote foodies. Everybody who goes on tour has an opinion about food, and food is a really important part of being on the road for everybody, no matter what your relationship is to food. So, you know, we tried to talk. This is an anthology, so we've got about 40 different contributors from all different backgrounds and different bands, different scenes, different eras of music, and everybody's got kind of a unique story to tell.
Yeah, I'm gonna. Let's leave it at that, because you're going to come back with Alex, and we're going to chit-chat about some specific stories. Speaking of stories, I want to talk about the story you wrote for Taste. Thank you for doing that. It was
Thank
great.
You for having me. I mean, it was, like, so fun. It was one of the best stories I've ever worked
on. It's a great piece, and it's all you, and you pitched it, and this is how it should work sometimes. But it's about menu hotlines, and I love the piece because it really taps into a style of dining and like a community around dining that we don't really talk about, and how food is expressed through the telephone. A very, very unique story. Tell us about what you were reporting on.
Yeah, well, so I got to give credit to my bandmate Greta, Greta Klein, the front person of Frankie Cosmos, at our annual Frankie Cosmos office holiday party.
Oh, cool.
Which we've kept up despite my retirement. she gave me this item, which I'm brandishing, called the Directory of American Menu Hotlines, which is this zine basically put together by an artist and writer based in Minneapolis named Andy Sturdivant, who I think is a genius. And it collects these phone numbers, mostly at institutions like hospitals, military bases, senior centers, churches, that you can call, and you get a pre-recorded answering machine that tells you the day's specials at that institution's dining facility. And when Greta gave this to me at first, I was kind of puzzled. And then I was flipping through, I called another number, and I was like, oh my God, I felt like I was, you know, like an archaeologist discovering the Rosetta Stone. I was like, I can't believe this exists, and I need to know more about it.
Yeah, I mean, looking at your interests in your anthropological studies, it seems like it would be a very cool thing to marinate on, but in general, they're really entertaining.
They're so entertaining.
And I want to play a couple examples. So what I'm going to do is you're going to list one. We'll do like three. So list one and then set it up, and then we'll play a little clip from that hotline. So what's the first one?
I mean, I think we've got to start with the Oyster Pearl Grill, which is the on-site dining facility at a hospital outside New Orleans. And the hotline reader there, a woman named Sharon Brown, who's worked in the cafeteria there for about 15 years, she's really kind of the queen of the genre.
Absolute iconic. It's been on my phone since you wrote the story.
Really? How often do you call?
Once a week or so. I don't go to it that often.
Yeah, but, fair enough.
But do you do it daily?
I do it daily. There's yeah, usually, you know, my wife and I work from home, so we'll be sitting at our desks, and then, you know, at a certain point, one of us will turn to the other and be like, should we call Sharon?
Exactly the first thing is basic. So let's play Sharon now.
Okay.
Good morning from the Oyster Pearl Grill. Happy Tuesday, March 19, 2024. On the menu today, we have the following. Y'all listen up close now. We have fried pork chops, barbecue brisket, smothered cabbage. I know, right? Do you know how fast that cabbage goes? We have green peas, eat-stick, flame roasted corn with jalapenos, fried green beans, baked beans, you eat grilled zucchini and squash, and grilled shrimp. The combo meal of the day is your fried pork chop, one side item, and a 16-ounce beverage. You eat meal to grilled shrimp, one eat side, and a 16-ounce beverage of water. The soup of the day is chili. No pun intended, but hey, you can always use a little chili when it's chili. Come on in, bring your smile and your appetite. We'll see you soon.
Still the most lovely woman. I would like to meet her one day. So.
I interviewed her for the piece. Yeah. I was starstruck. Yeah. I need to go there.
Yeah,
I
mean, it's definitely part of like visiting these. What's the next one you want to call out?
Man, it's really hard to choose. Just
yeah, I know. There's a lot. We'll link to the story in the show notes and definitely check it out.
I think I want to call the original Harvey's Family Restaurant in Taylor, South Carolina. So what's interesting about this is that there's actually not that many restaurants that have hotlines. It's predominantly these like institutional settings, as I was saying. But Andy, who put together the directory, there is a mini directory within the directory that is called the Family Restaurants of Alabama and South Carolina Supplement.
Wow.
Because it's like it seems to just be a thing in Alabama and South Carolina. And there's about seven of them. But I really like Harvey's. So this is going to ring.
Okay.
And like part of the fun here is there's always this little like, is someone going to pick up this time? You know, every time I call, yeah, today, actually, I screwed up one of the numbers and I was calling a hospital menu line and someone picked up and was like, radiology. And I was like,
guys, we're trying to get the menu line. We're trying to figure out what type of beans are being prepared.
But if you dial correctly, then no one's going to pick up. So
yeah,
anyway, here's Harvey's.
You've got the original Harvey's Family Restaurants menu line Tuesday, and we'll be open 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. And this is what's on our menu for this Tuesday. Of course, we have that great country fried steak smothered in white gravy. Then we'll have our good old meatloaf. We'll have a grilled teriyaki chicken breast, alabaster chicken. We'll have a fried pork chop. We'll feature a fish of the day. Then we'll have that grilled Greek chicken. Our vegetables are mashed potatoes and gravy, rice and gravy, green beans, macaroni and cheese, fried okra. We'll have a bean of the day, cream style corn, potato salad, pickled beets, applesauce, coleslaw, a vegetable and dessert of the day. Then we'll have some fresh fruit, stewed okra and tomatoes, our roasted red potatoes. And then we'll have those great variety of salads, sandwiches, wraps, and of course, that lasagna dinner. We look forward to seeing you for lunch and dinner on Tuesday. Thank you for calling, and have a blessed day.
He's kind of like, he reminds me of a pilot, like, yeah. Or, you know, a flight attendant over the PA telling you, like, you know, your cruising altitude.
I was in his warm cocoon.
There's an ASMR quality.
It did, and it's a balanced diet.
Yeah.
I'm like pickled beets.
Pickled beets, applesauce. There's this, you get into the group when you call every day. Like
you know some of their reps. I mean, yeah. And he's like, of course we got lasagna, like always. Like,
yeah.
Lasagna's always on.
Yeah.
What's the third one you want to call out? I know we can call out these all day. But.
Yeah. I think we should do, there's this Lutheran church outside Minneapolis where the reader has this really calming presence, and I think there's this wholesomeness that I think really speaks to, you know, the culture in general.
Love the upper Midwest.
Yeah,
just gotta love the upper Midwest. Yeah.
Hello, welcome to Westwood's Community Meal Menu Line. I hope you're enjoying the warm weather. We'll have it for today and tomorrow, and they say it will get cool on Thursday. Tomorrow, March 13th, we will serve sloppy joe on a bun, whole kernel corn, baked carrots, a cheese slice, pickled chips, seasonal fruit, and a dessert. The meal is from 5 to 6:30 in Good Shepherd Hall. Next week, March 20th, we'll have ham and cheese egg bake, veggies and dip, fruit muffin, and a fresh fruit cup. We hope to see you here.
I love.
Oh, goodness.
I can't even do it anymore. I've been away for 20 years. Egg bake. Mm-hmm. Egg bake. My mom kind of gets it right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not. I can't say that the accents aren't.
It's so great.
Fun part of calling them for sure.
But. I love it. Let me ask you one more band question. Your favorite band to share a meal with?
So, you know, I don't know if this paints me in the best light, but I prefer not to eat with other bands.
Yeah, I get it.
I like to eat with my own band.
You want to be the star,
I was in a
buddy.
Band with my wife.
You want to be the star.
No, it's just I was in a band with my wife. The two of us like to go off and enjoy our meals in private.
Yeah. Did you guys meet? Were you like together when you joined the band, or did you meet while?
We met in the band.
Interesting.
We met in the band.
And that's a whole
our
thing.
Band was actually two couples. So sometimes the four of us would eat together. Sometimes we'd kind of go off in our
Ricky
couples.
Ricky Cosmos was two couples.
Yeah.
Interesting. I didn't know that. I'm sorry.
They say that's not advisable, but you
it
know,
worked
I,
out, I guess.
I disagree, yeah.
It worked out really well. Luke, on This Is Taste, we ask guests about their discerning taste. So to close this interview, here's a little rapid-fire Fast and Furious taste check. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
The best fruit?
The Julie mango.
Yeah, what's the season on that we're looking at?
Well, in the Caribbean where it's eaten, I believe you're looking at like fall, December, and then by January, February, they're done.
They're done. The worst vegetable.
Acorn squash.
You're the second in 2 weeks who've said that.
Really?
It's truly hot trash. Yeah,
yeah,
it's not a good one.
Yeah.
They're also like, it's how you like cut off your finger, like trying to
cut. Oh, true, yeah.
So like
I wouldn't be cutting one, so
no,
I wouldn't.
It's just banned from your house. The best dessert.
Grape nut pudding.
Explain, please, sir.
That is a New England dessert. It's like a custard with post grape nut cereal baked into it. Grape nuts, of course, being, you know, one of the hardest foods. I mean, really a hard food, like pebbles.
It has a ball bearing quality to it.
But like when you bake it in a custard, it retains some of that texture, and it's delicious.
It's a delightful texture. Gonna have to take your word for that one. I mean, I like grape nuts as a theory, but
you ever had grape nut ice cream?
No, I haven't.
Oh, fantastic.
My guy, I need to do this. I like where you're going here with the grape nuts. Maybe we'll work on a story.
I want to write about grape nuts. You know what's interesting? It's very popular in the Caribbean and it's popular in ice cream and in New England.
Yeah.
There's a lot to say.
I think there's a lot to say. Your favorite American fast food chain?
Maybe Pollo Tropical in South Florida.
Yeah. I've not been there, but I've heard of it.
Really good. Good.
Your favorite New York City restaurant right now?
Kafana.
Oh, I love that call.
I love Kafana.
Classic. Yeah.
You never feel bad when you're leaving Kafana.
It's good. Is that down? That's in the East Village?
Alphabet City, yeah.
Your favorite cookbook of all time?
Probably. I mean, I don't really use it to cook from, but just for the pros, Nose to Tail Cooking.
Fergus. I saw that you're a big Fergus head. I mean, do you go... When you're there,
you go
to St. John?
Yeah, the mothership. I love it. And it's always so great. I mean, Rochelle Canteen is also great. Margot is amazing, too.
Yeah.
So both of them. But yeah, I love it.
I went to the one on Brick Lane this past summer.
Mm-hmm.
That was good.
Yeah.
It's a good one.
I mean, he's a genius. But just the headers, the recipe headers, incredible.
Great book.
And one time I did cook a bowl of quails from that book.
Oh, you did?
It turned out all right.
All right. It works. We've been marinating in a St. John cookbook story for a while, writers. To be continued. Your favorite recent cookbook discovery?
That would be West Winds by Riaz Phillips. And he has a newer one actually called East Winds, but West Winds is a Jamaican cookbook. He's a brilliant writer. I think he lives in Berlin, but British Caribbean.
Yeah.
West Winds is a great book, and I just think Jamaican cuisine doesn't always get that treatment or the respect that it really deserves.
So, very cool. I've heard of the name, but I've never actually gotten a copy.
Yeah.
It's a good reminder. Your favorite album right now?
Well, I mean, I shouted out my co-author's new album, Daniel by Real Estate, which just came out. It's great. I'll also say Katie von Schleicher, who engineered the most recent Frankie Kosmos album, and she's now playing in Frankie, but she, in her solo career, is amazing. Her new album is called A Little Touch of Schleicher in the Night.
That's a great name.
Yeah.
Wow, way to like leverage a beautiful last name. Who took your job in the band? Did someone take your job?
It's a
or is it just a drum machine?
It's ChatGPT. No, it's a rotating cast. There's a few drummers, all of whom I wholeheartedly approve of.
Do they speak four languages and enjoy Kafana? No.
Everyone would like Kafana.
I feel you got this job.
I don't speak Serbian also.
Oh, that's
so
true. That's,
you know,
actually
I can't
bad.
Really do much there.
I feel you got this job if you want it back. I just feel, just for the restaurant picks. But you're retired, man.
I'm retired. Strictly.
But Jordan, I mean, they come out. I mean, Brady... They come out of retirement sometimes.
Brady wouldn't like Kafana.
No, he wouldn't like... Ooh, that's your guy. Or maybe not. Are you a Patriots fan?
No.
Okay, no, absolutely
strictly
not.
Strictly no.
Strictly no. All right, a few more. A cuisine you'd like to learn more about?
Persian.
Yeah.
You know, similar to the Arab cuisines that I know and love, but different enough that I've got a lot to learn.
Really cool idea. I mean, and also like the diaspora in America is pretty pronounced and prominent.
Yeah.
So be cool to dig in. Last one, your favorite sandwich.
In general or in New York?
Man, in general, we're going ever, all time.
Eggplant parm.
Place to get it?
You know, I don't eat them that often. That's the thing. Yeah, I don't eat them that often. I mean, I used to love them from Parm. I haven't had one from there in a while. Parm's kind of changed a bit, but...
Great one. Luke, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining this.
Thank you. So nice.
This is Taste is hosted by Eliza Abarbanel and me, Matt Rodbar. The show is produced by Shalia Harris and Pat Stango and edited by Clayton Gumbert. Theme music by Steve Rydell. Visit Taste online at tastecooking.com and make sure to subscribe to our newsletter for updates on all cool things that are happening.